You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Skate Podcast on WEEI.com.
Bobby Orr, behind the net to Sanderson, to Orr! Bobby Orr!
For the first time in 39 years, the Boston Bruins have won the Stanley Cup.
Talking Bruins and NHL.
Sure, old-time hockey. Like it is sure. Yeah.
With writer and producer Brian DeFelice.
Brian DeFelice is an emerging talent.
Bridget Prue.
Yeah, he's a little bit on the hot seat.
Burn him!
And WEEI.com Bruins writer Scott McLaughlin.
Great Scott!
Lace him up for some Bees talk right now.
I'm a damn dog!
It's the Skate Pod on WEEI.
Welcome into episode 157 of the Skate Podcast. I am Brian DeFelice, joined by Bridget Prue and Scott McLaughlin. Bruins lost their sixth regular season game of the season, and we are in late January. They lost that to the Lightning down in Tampa Bay. It was a pretty intense game, really competitive game, fun game to watch. I think the Bruins did a lot of good, but there was also the fair share of bad. In particular, in the last 20 minutes, we'll get to all of that, the good, bad, and the ugly. I think that it's not necessarily a bad thing to lose a hard-fought game and get reminded of, you know, what the big boys in the playoffs are going to be like and what's harder to do against some of the better teams. But for now, I'm going to throw it to Bridget and Scott, you guys. What'd you guys make of the game tonight against Tampa?
Yeah, I thought it was a great game, obviously. You know, similar to the Toronto game almost 2 weeks ago, it's like, yeah, this is what playoff hockey feels like, or, you know, pretty close to it. And I think my big takeaway, like, from the combination of those two games, because they're two of the best games we've seen this season, is you really don't want to have to go through any path that involves facing both of those teams, which, you know, like, there's been some talk recently about, you know, does it really matter if the Bruins run away from the lead? Does, you know, should they care about the single season points record? And it's like, all right, like, that's one thing, but you know what does matter and what is really important is finishing first in this division and not getting stuck in that 2-3 dogfight that Toronto and Tampa are going to be in. You know, those two teams, assuming, now I know we can't assume, because in 2019 the Lightning did not get out of the first round when they were the record setting team, but if the Bruins get out of the first round, then Toronto or Tampa has to go through each other and then the Bruins. If you only have to face one of them, like, that is a huge help when it comes to looking at, like, what your path to a Stanley Cup is going to be. It's going to be, I think, significantly easier to only have to go through one of those teams. And that second round matchup could very well end up being, like, the toughest series that you get.
Yeah, that's true. And to, you know, bring it back to this game, and, you know, it did feel like a playoff game. It was kind of funny. In the beginning, there was kind of like competing chants in the crowd for Bruins and Tampa Bay. And, like, it seemed like the fans were even, like, getting involved in it as kind of a more playoff like atmosphere. Key thing that it seemed like was going to be the most important thing, and I don't believe Montgomery was asked by Jack and Brick after the game about this, was the fact that Charlie McAvoy looked like he had another shoulder injury in the third period, and he actually came back 2 minutes later, which I was not anticipating, and played out the rest of the game. So that was like a huge sigh of relief, because as the air came out of the building and the broadcast when McAvoy went down to the end boards behind Ullmark's net. And you're just like, okay, this is bad. And to my surprise, 2 minutes later, he comes out on the power play and he looks fine. So that was just one of those things in a game like this that you worry about, because it is a team that's going to play you so physically. And you're just thinking, okay, well, they win or lose, whatever, you know, they want points, but not a huge deal if they lose. But if they lose McAvoy, that is a big deal.
Yeah, Scott. That was the same shoulder he got surgery on in the offseason too. So, you know, you worry about that. You know, I guess anytime with shoulders, like you want to make sure going forward now, like there's nothing there that lingers. You know, sometimes guys will return quickly from something like that, but then it kind of nags, or, you know, it pops out at some point, or, you know, like we saw that with Grizzlick last year, right? Like he played through it and, you know, was okay at times, but then it kind of kept bothering him and kept getting worse. So still longer term, like you want to make sure there's nothing there that's going to linger with McAvoy. But yes, obviously a huge sigh of relief that he was able to come back.
And now the recovery for the shoulder surgery in the off season was how many months? I forget. It took a while, wasn't it?
May surgery.
Yeah, 6 months. So that would mean that if it was damaged, he either would have to play through it or be out the rest of the season. So like if it comes back that in the morning he goes through tests and it's a re-injury, then he's in a situation where either he tries to play through it, like you mentioned, like him and Grizzlick did last season, or do you just take him out of the picture? So, I mean, everybody's just hoping that he's fine. And the fact that he got back in that game is a very strong indication that he is.
Yeah. I'd have to imagine that based on him returning not too long after the actual incident itself, I don't think that the medical staff and the training staff would put him back in harm's way if it was, to your point, like you can sleep on it and then you never know, like something can come up overnight after some time. But that said, I would just be surprised if it wasn't anything more than a scare. Guys, I want to bring up three things that I think Tampa Bay did well against Boston that most teams don't. And this is why when you get later into the season and you go into the playoffs and you're playing these caliber style of teams, as I said, it's a reminder of why Boston, or what Boston won't necessarily be able to do at will against a quality opponent over seven games like they do against, say, San Jose or Montreal or something like that. And just to preface, like, I think Boston played really well in the first 40. Yeah, there were some hiccups, but I thought they played fine. And this is not me saying the Bruins suck tonight. I'm just bringing up three things that I thought statistically Tampa did well tonight. The first thing, especially in the second period. So after the first period, I think the teams were 8-8 in the faceoff circle. After the first 40 minutes of play, I think it was like 22-12 in favor of Tampa. They were very strong in the faceoff circle. I think after 60 minutes, 52% for Tampa, 48% for Boston. Faceoffs are a huge part of Boston's game, and it leads to possession and dictating where the play goes. So I wanted to mention that. Tampa was effective on a power play. Obviously, Boston has the top PK in the league. Tampa was effective there. And then the third thing is just, I thought Tampa was very effective on the forecheck and didn't let Boston get to their transition game as often as they usually do. And that's a common theme when the Bruins run into somebody in the playoffs that gives them trouble and eventually bounces them, is that forecheck game. So those three things, faceoff dot, special teams, and forechecking. And I think Boston was fine in those three categories, but I do think Tampa Bay had the edge in those three tonight.
Yeah, they did. I wouldn't be super concerned though. Like, Tampa's not a great faceoff team in the season. They're kind of middle of the pack. Just over 50%. You know, Bruins have been an awesome faceoff team. I think they're second in the league. And you know, some of those goals, it's like,
well, the most important,
the goals that Tampa got, I think, were very fixable. If you're the Bruins, like the power play goal, you end up with Carlo and Forber kind of sucking over to the same side of the ice to the same guy, which you don't see very often from the Bruins. Penalty kill, they're usually very good about, you know, kind of staying where they're supposed to stay and having good spacing and not, you know, Brent Hagel ends up wide open all alone in front of the net. Like that, you almost never see that from the Bruins penalty kill. The faceoff should have been a faceoff violation, the Kucherov goal. Like Stamkos is basically like leaning over the dot before the puck's dropped and has Krejci's stick tied up. That was just bad miss by the linesman. And then what was the third goal?
It was a collision. It was the collision with Allmark and Carlo.
Right. So, yeah, again, like Carlo, I think, has generally been really strong this season. Actually makes like a decent play to kind of disrupt the rush in the first place, but just kind of loses his position a little bit too close to Allmark and takes him out. So, you know, yes, credit to Tampa, but I also feel like they weren't those goals weren't hugely concerning from the Bruins ends because I don't think they exposed any bigger problems. I think they were just like, all right, some stuff to clean up. And, you know, that's about as far as my concern level would go.
Yeah. And their most important, Tampa Bay's most important faceoff one was a violation. It was cheating. So it was like, okay, they're, you know, they scored right off a faceoff, but put a little asterisk next to it because there were just a lot of anomalies in the game in terms of officiating. It's just some really weird plays, like some high sticks that weren't called, some icings that were, you know, called icing when they weren't, or not called icing when they were. Just a really oddly officiated game. And you do see some of those in the playoffs, so it's no excuse to not, you know, be able to fight your way through it. But still, it seemed like a frustrating game, and that kind of, it did change the flow of the game.
And that's and on that third game winning goal by Tampa, I know it's easy to look at Carlo in that play just because he ended up going over the, you know, tripping up Allmark and himself and all that stuff. But if you trace that play back, you know, it's a poorly executed neutral zone pinch by Lindholm that even gives Tampa that odd man rush in the first place. So if you're going to give dish blame around there, then Lindholm has to wear that as well. But as to why I think this was a good loss for Boston, because I think if you ask Boston to a player, like they want to kind of go through some nights where things don't go their way, and they lose the game 3-2 with a chance to tie it late, goalie pulled. They're right there in the thick of things. They come back twice to tie the game. Tampa barely gets by with a win at home in a very motivated game for them. And I feel like a lot of things had to go Tampa's way for that to happen. You guys mentioned the false draw where Kucherov scores off of it. Stamkos leans over the dot. Krejci, which by the way was a weird play because the Bruins took a long time to set up their face-off positioning there before that happened. And then they just kind of like give up a goal right away. It was kind of ironic, but yeah, a lot went Tampa's way. And before the game, the media was asking John Cooper what makes Boston so effective. And he basically said one of the things he said was that they don't beat themselves. And I thought that tonight, in the third period in particular, they beat themselves. And I think that, you know, that just doesn't happen very often. So when you have a game where Tampa gets some fortuitous bounces, some luck here and there, and Boston kind of was their own worst enemy at times, like, and that barely was enough to beat Boston on the road, I think it's just affirmation. It takes a lot to beat the Bruins once, let alone four times in the playoffs.
Yeah, and the one thing where I will give Tampa a lot of credit is they did control that game in the third for pretty long stretches of time, and that's something we have not seen often is teams that have been able to go the distance with the Bruins and, you know, go 12 rounds and be able to control play in the third and still get offensive zone time and not be on their heels. Like usually the Bruins are the team kind of overpowering teams by that point because, you know, because of their depth, because they've done it before, because they have that confidence in themselves that, you know, they're always going to find a way to get it done in the third. you know, the Lightning kind of threw some of that back and gained some of that confidence themselves tonight. So that's, you know, if you're the Bruins, like, I feel like one of the main, obviously you want to win every game, but, you know, this would have been a season sweep over Tampa. Would have given you a chance to, you know, really kind of like take their soul, sort of, right? Like, they're playing well and you still go in and beat them. So I think the Lightning probably got some confidence out of that and feel like, hey, you know, we went toe to toe with the best. We took control in the third period. Like, we can do this. So, you know, absolutely no reason to panic or really worry if you're the Bruins, but you did kind of, you know, let the Lightning gain that little bit of extra confidence ahead of, you know, potential future meeting.
In the playoffs too, scoring first is such a big deal, and the Bruins trailed. They never led in the game against Tampa tonight. So you kind of just feel like Tampa Bay was allowed to play a little bit different style of game than if they were chasing it, especially in the third period when they got the lead, the 3-2 lead. They were able to be more aggressive on the forecheck, and they were able to put more pressure on the Bruins. And you could just see that they were playing a style that you probably want to stick away from if it's a tied game. So that's also something to keep in mind, is that it shows you that, you know, the Bruins were in the game all the way to the end. Goalie gets pulled, still looking like they're getting chances. But the importance of scoring first is definitely so simple, but in the playoffs, it makes such a big difference.
And by the way, just to correct myself, they do play the Lightning one more time in March, but, you know,
Boston, right? Yeah.
Point stands though, like, season sweep would have been on the table if you win, and instead Tampa gets it.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yes. Look, so I think to get to some of the positives for Boston in this game, right? And as I mentioned earlier, there were a lot of them. It was a very, very competitive, hard-fought game all the way around. But as I mentioned previously, Tampa was able to do some things tonight that typically the Bruins get the upper hand in. One of the things I didn't mention, which thankfully you guys just brought up, was the third period. Like, Boston's always dominant in the third period all year. They're going to continue to be so, and I'm not concerned about it at all. But if you're looking at some of the reasons why they lost tonight, that's another thing that Tampa just kind of was better than them at tonight, was the third period. And you guys already covered that, so I'm not going to go there. But as far as what the Bruins did well, both of their goals were a thing of beauty. The first goal to tie the game 1-1, 4-4, it was Boston 2022-2023 Boston Bruins hockey, right? It was possession, it was movement without the puck. And Brad Marchand was able to take a nice little pass from Clifton after some good work by Pastrnak, and he was able to go 5-full on a quick snapshot to tie the game 1-1. What did you guys make of that 4-4 goal? Again, the Bruins controlled play a lot, I thought, for the first 40 minutes, and this came on the heels of Taylor Hall getting a goalie interference penalty on Vasilevsky for a nothing play. I mean, it was kind of like, Sergachev kind of guided him into Vasilevsky, and it was no harm, no foul type thing. I mean, yeah, if you want to call goalie interference, go for it. That got negated when Sergachev just kind of went Paul Bunyan on Taylor Hall, made it 4-4. And then the Bruins took over, made that count in the aforementioned Marchand goal.
Yeah. It was sort of a puck don't lie moment, because I felt like the Bruins should have had the power play out of that. Like, Sergachev did way more than Hall. Like, the initial collision is Sergachev knocking Hall into Vasilevsky, and, like, you know, I don't know, maybe Hall would have made contact anyways, but
do you think you can't anything,
know that? And then Sergachev just, like, throws five cross checks. What
do you think the fact that Sergachev reacted as if Hall had really like done this himself, like led to the penalty being called? Because he responded as if this was like the worst thing anyone could have done to his goalie and he had nothing to do with it. So I almost wonder if how bad Sergachev's response was led to them thinking that it was more than it was.
It's a good question, but I saw on the side replay, the arm went up right away before Sergachev got in there.
Okay. Yeah. True.
So I don't know, but anyways, like I thought if anything, that should have been a Bruins power play. It ends up 4-4 and just great puck possession play by the Bruins. Like they change out three of the four guys on the ice within about 10 seconds of that goal and just keep in possession, walking the blue line. And then you end up with the great shot by Marchand to finish it. So that was impressive. The second goal that the Bruins got, equally impressive in terms of puck movement with the check line. You know, Pastrnak makes a great dangle to get around a Lightning defender. I thought Pastrnak did that a lot tonight. I think had some great passes. Really, you know, ends up with only 1 point, right? I don't think he assisted on the first one. Yeah, so 1 point, but could have easily had three or four. Like he was slinging sauce all over the place.
Slinging sauce and puck, yeah. Don't lie.
And so then Krejci gets it over to Zacha. So two pretty goals by the Bruins.
And just an all-around game from Pastrnak where you see that he's not scoring, but he's still impacting the game so much. And he's making plays that they didn't score on, but that pass to Lindholm, like that Lindholm ends up going around the net and trying to wrap around after, but he's somehow sees Lindholm crashing, makes this backhand pass all the way through, you know, the center of the ice where there's a bunch of defenders, and it makes it perfectly where it needs to go. And he did it a few times where he just somehow made this pass, and it brings us back to something that we talked about before, that Pastrnak used to see himself in his game as a playmaker and someone with the vision to set things up rather than just that like threat to score, especially like on that one time shot. So was a threat in a lot of areas. I think he blocked a shot and I was like, okay, maybe don't do that because maybe you don't want to see him step in front of a slap shot. But he was doing all the little things right and possessing and passing and kind of just showing that his skill set is not just scoring.
Yeah, and early on in the second period, the only stretch of play from him I didn't really like was when the Bruins had that that 5-on-4 penalty that carried over at the end of the first period. Bruins came out in the second period and just they weren't crisp. I think Pastrnak tried to hit somebody up the middle, went for icing or something like that, and then he ended up taking a penalty to negate the power play. But aside from that, like 30-second stretch, to your point, Bridget, he was all over the ice. That pass Lindholm was beautiful. In a game like this, it's a big boy game, and you have guys back there like Chernak and Bogosian and Hedman and guys that can wear down opposing forwards down low. So in a game like this, I really try to see, all right, obviously Pastrnak can you know, do whatever he wants when he has time and space, but you know, is he gonna, how's he gonna fare in those one-on-one battles and whatnot and races to loose pucks? And to my eyes, he passed that test with flying colors tonight. I thought that it was interesting. David Krejci once again just makes me like eat my own words because there were so many times this game where I just thought the Bruins had one too many passes. They gave up opportunities to shoot. And look, who am I to tell these guys how to play hockey? I mean, somebody like Krejci, you know, he's top 10 in Bruins franchise every statistical category besides goal scoring, which I think he's just outside the top 10. So the guy knows what he's doing. But sometimes you can't help it. The fan in you just kind of wants to yell shoot like you're in the 300s at the Garden. But that said, when the Bruins tie the game 2-2, it's because he takes that extra second to find Zacha. And it's right. Like you think he has a chance to shoot that puck, and he does, but he elects to pass it. And next thing you know, it's 2-2. So, you know, there goes Krejci again. Just tell him, keep down, Brian, keep down. So I'll keep down if you want me to, but keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I just caught Krejci's post-game press conference right before we started recording. And he even admitted, he was like, yeah, there were maybe a couple of other times we overpassed a little, and it's like, yeah, there were, you know, there was the one in particular where Pasternak gets it to him and he has a shooting lane, but he tries to get it over to Hall instead. And the defender was already shading over to Hall. So it's like, they were giving you the shot and, you know, he just didn't take it. And you live with it. I think he's gotten better at that over the course of his career of taking shots when they're there. But every now and then that, you know, diehard pass first instinct that he has will come back to bite him. And like, you know, to your point, it's like he's awesome. He knows what he's doing. 95 times out of 100, he's going to do the right thing. But, you know, when he does pass on the shot, like, and it's there, it's frustrating. You know, obviously, and it's like, it's almost a running joke. Like Pasternak even joked about that earlier this season when he made a comment of like, well, we know Krejci's not going to shoot, so someone has to type thing. So, yeah, you know, I think Krejci will probably watch a video on that and be like, yeah, okay, I should have shot that.
I think it should have been fairly obvious, like 2 seconds after he made the pass. That, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Well, if you watch, yeah, sorry, Bridget, what were you saying?
No, go ahead, because I was going to change the subject.
Well, if you watch that play as well, like we're all talking about that second period play, I think, down the other end where he had a chance to shoot in the slot. If you do watch that replay, if he wanted to shoot that puck, he would have had to have done it like right away, because as a righty, he got to a point where he turned so much that he wouldn't have much power behind it. It would be kind of a little bit of a flimsy snapshot, if anything. And I think that in his mind, he was like, I'd rather dish this than not get a lot behind a shot. If you watch the replay, you'll see what I'm talking about. His body was kind of a little too tilted at that point, but I digress. What did you want to bring up, Bridget?
So this was something we mentioned could happen a few podcasts ago. And ever since DeBrusque has been out, we were talking about maybe Taylor Hall could go to the first line, but that it was kind of unconventional and maybe not the best thing to do, because he would have to play his offside on the right wing. And he would, you know, he hasn't played. We don't know the last time he's played on the right side, because you're going to leave Marchand on left, Bergeron center. And so you take him off the third line and he goes up with Marchand and Bergeron. How do you think he played in that role?
I thought it was other than that one good drive to the net where, you know, he gets called for goal interference, that was a fairly quiet game for Taylor Hall. And I don't know that it's necessarily related to the switch versus just being kind of a quiet game for him in general. There weren't any instances that I noticed of like him looking awkward out there playing right wing. And, you know, and both him and Marchand said before the game, like, it was going to be pretty interchangeable. Like, sure, they'll line up Marchand left, Hall right. But then, you know, if someone's higher up on the forecheck and they're on the other side of the ice, they'll just switch. If someone comes back first, you know, they'll just track the play to whatever side of the ice it goes. Like, you know, I think they're both fine with, you know, we're going to end up where we end up. We don't have to just stay on our wings. So, and I think you saw that play out a few times. So I don't think that, you know, the move to the right side is why he had a quieter night. I just thought it was, you know, kind of, obviously the last couple games had been really good for him. And this was a little bit more of what we had seen in the few weeks prior where, you know, he's just not quite as involved as you want him to be.
I would say that if I'm Jim Montgomery, I'm going to give him another opportunity. I don't see the harm in allowing them. It's to take one game and just shut down the option, I think is silly. I think it's stubborn. Because on one hand, I'm with Scott. I definitely thought that it was a quiet night for Hall. I didn't think that line was all too dangerous. 5-on-5. I don't know if the scoring chances back me up there, or high danger scoring chances, but it wasn't a phenomenal game. If you only had one opportunity, sorry, Scott. Yep.
As a line, they had 4 scoring chances, 1 high danger.
Okay. Yeah. That kind of bears out. So if you only had one chance, one opportunity, to seize everything he ever wanted. I don't think he captured it, but I do think that.
All right, podcast is over.
I do think they have the. I got the beanie on too, so I feel like I'm. But I do think you just give him another chance and see what happens. I don't see why you would rush him off that. Now maybe you put him back in the third line or some or down the lineup because you didn't think the third line was great tonight. But I think you go with another game or two with him with on that top line.
Yeah, and you see Smith go back to the third line, and we talked about like, oh, Hall has a certain, you know, dynamic threat on the third line, but he hadn't been really performing that way on the third line anyway. So you move him to the top line. I don't know if it's just because I've had a bad week, but I was just excited to see it. As soon as I saw the lineup, I was like, okay, this is great. I'm going to watch this and this is going to be fun. Cause I just, in my mind was like, I have no idea how this is going to look and I just want to see it. So one thing that it did, I did want to point out about the move and how it affected, you know, that line and the third line is that throughout the season, Hall has always played on a line where two guys were centers at least at some point in their career. And I can't remember the last time I've seen Taylor Hall, maybe once this season. I don't know how many times he's taken a face off this season, but he took one in this game. And he doesn't have to on the third line because Coyle and Frederick are both guys that have played center. And then when he's playing on the second line, Krejci and Zacha are two guys that can take face off. So he's always the third option for the face offs and doesn't usually get in at the dot. So it's just kind of funny to see him there.
Hall has apparently actually taken 8 face offs this season.
I can't remember another.
That's more than I would have guessed.
And it's just because, like we mentioned, Frederick used to be a center and still at times has played center for the Bruins this season and in recent years. And then Zacha, obviously, we've talked about how he could be an option at center if you lose Bergeron or Krejci because that's how his natural position is as well. So you never see Hall in that role. Maybe that's a problem because Marchand doesn't take many faceoffs either. You're kind of just leaving it to Bergeron, but
Marchand is usually the second guy, though.
Yeah, he's the second option. I think, yeah, this must have been a situation where both of them got waived or something, and it ended up with Hall.
I mean, Marchand's usually the second guy, but it's an automatic loss. He doesn't really try much on him. He more so just kind of, like, gets a head start on going behind the centerman to chase after it. I want to rescind a take I had the other day. I think it was a little premature, a little unfair of me. And Scott kind of agreed with me, so maybe he'll also rescind. Kopanen, I thought that maybe the first game he was a little overwhelmed because he's definitely settled in the last few games with his trial stint with the Bruins. And Scott, I don't know if you have how many faceoffs each player won tonight in front of you. I don't know if you have tab like that. Do you?
Yeah, okay. Kopanen won 11. Kopanen won 4, lost 7, so he's 36%. To be fair, Bergeron was 39%, so he wasn't much better.
Well, I must have really paid attention to Kopanen's 4 faceoff wins because I thought that the last few games he's been pretty good in the faceoff circle, but I guess he hasn't. But regardless, he's definitely settled in a little bit.
Yeah, he's been pretty good on faceoffs in general, tonight aside. But yeah, I thought it was another pretty strong game for him and for that line. I was, you know, when we were just talking about the other lines, I was looking and that line was the only line that had multiple high danger chances tonight with all three members on the ice. You know, I don't know about mixing and matching and stuff. But the other three lines all only had one each and the Foligno, Kopanen, and Greer line had 3. So, and it kind of felt like that. Like they had some good offensive zone shifts. I thought, especially in the second period, like, and even like early in the third, like when there were some lulls in the Bruins, kind of offensive opportunities, they were able to at least generate some momentum by getting down the offensive zone and keeping some possession there. So, Kopanen has not looked overwhelmed. And obviously this is a, you know, this is the probably the biggest test yet, facing a team like Tampa, and especially that D-core. Like, you know, you want to see how he holds up against that. And I thought he more than held his own. So that's, you know, it's a tough situation for Montgomery, right? Because, like, they call up Mark McLaughlin and bring him on this road trip, and presumably you want to get him in at some point and not have him just, you know, sit for an entire road trip.
Just hanging out.
But it's like, all right, well, who are you taking out? Because that fourth line continues to perform pretty well. Kopanen seems to be getting better with each game. So, you know, you're not going to sit someone when they don't deserve it. So, you know, unfortunately for McLaughlin, I mean, now there's a back-to-back coming up Saturday, Sunday. So maybe if someone's a little nicked up, you know, that's an easy opportunity to get him in there on Sunday or something. But otherwise, you know, I think Kopanen deserves to stay in. I think Greer's doing enough to stay in. So, you know, maybe you look at Craig Smith, but
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I was thinking that I think Mick, and this is nothing against Craig Smith, but I wouldn't mind McLaughlin on the right side with Frederick and Coyle. I think that could be a good quick heavy line with some puck possession. And I do think McLaughlin's first NHL career goal was on a pass by Frederick on a 2-on-1, but I don't know if they played much 5-on-5 together, if that was more of a line change type thing. But, well, no, it was probably, I don't know what.
I think they were on the same line. Yeah. I think he was with them a little bit.
I could see McLaughlin complimenting Frederick and Coyle a little bit better than Smith right now. So, and again, I like Craig Smith as a person, but for right now, I just think it's a long season. Like, see what you have, right? You never know.
Yeah, so. And you'd rather take a guy out of the lineup that feels relatively secure in the role. Like, I know Craig Smith has been scratched at different points of this season, but, like, if you're Kopanen and you're just trying to hang on and prove yourself, like, he's at the point in his career where if he does play well, you need to reward him. Whereas, you know, it's okay to get Smith a night off if you just want to, you know, use McLaughlin because you have the ability to because you called him up to see him. So, yeah, I think Craig Smith would be the most obvious choice to switch McLaughlin in for. And I wanted to comment on Kopanen because I agree. He does seem to have settled in. And it's one of those things where you see a guy get a chance for the first time after playing in the AHL and you're wanting to see whether or not they can adapt to NHL pace, NHL size, you know, guys that can make moves around you. And I thought his defending and his pressure that he put on was really good. He didn't get beat. I can't remember a time that he did, at least against Tampa Bay. And he's also taking up time penalty killing, which is big. And he's not getting beat by guys on the penalty when he's penalty killing. So he's definitely earned that spot in the meantime while Nosek is out. Until he shows a reason, like a letdown, then you leave him there.
Another Bruin who I thought had a strong night and I think passed the test for us against a strong opponent would be Linus Ullmark. I don't fault him on the Hagel goal. I don't fault him on the Hedman goal, the game-winning goal, because he kind of got taken out by his teammate there. The Kucherov goal, you know, but, I mean, it's off a face-off. It's bang-bang. And I thought he had a ton of point-blank chances, especially in the last 20 minutes when the Bruins got a little careless with the puck. There were a lot of turnovers down low, and I thought Ullmark was there to bail him out, and he gave him a chance up until the very end, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, really more of the same. Like, it feels so repetitive to come on after every game and be like, oh, goaltending was great, but it just has been.
Me writing the section, like the explanation of each episode, Ullmark and Swayman, great. Like in every single description of every single episode.
Yeah, although I do think that with Ullmark losing, giving up 3 goals, I think Swayman now moves back ahead of him in terms of stats over like the last month and a half, 2 months. They've been going like neck and neck where I think Swayman was a little ahead. And then, oddly enough, Swayman giving up 2 goals on 22 shots dropped him behind Ullmark again, like or over this last 20-game stretch or so. And so now Ullmark probably dropped back below him. But, they've both had just this unbelievable stretch where it's like their numbers are off the charts over what's basically now like a 2 month stretch since either one of them struggled at all or certainly struggled for like multiple games.
See, I think this is a notable game to bring up, Allmark, because anytime you are lining up across the ice from Vasilevsky, especially when you are the individual who is the favorite for the Vezina, I think there's a lot of eyes on that game, and I think in many ways it's Allmark. Anytime you can play against Vasilevsky, it's kind of a measuring stick game for Allmark in his mind, probably because Vasilevsky has been the gold standard the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years and at that position. So I thought on the road, in a game where his team wasn't as strong defensively in front of him as they usually are, I thought he was excellent. And because, you know, I bring it up because as good as the goaltending has been this year, I think that as we get closer to the playoffs, you're going to hear a lot of pundits and just media personalities and maybe some fans too. They're going to try to think to themselves, well, what could possibly go wrong for the Bruins in the playoffs this year? Because everything's gone their way and they're the favorites, blah, blah, blah. And I think one thing that people are going to hang their hats on is, well, the Bruins goaltending is unproven in the playoffs. So any opportunity in the regular season, you get a chance to see Allmark and Swayman gear up for a game. Like, it is a playoff game. It's notable to me. And I thought that he passed that test with flying colors tonight, despite the losing effort.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as far as like the playoff storyline goes, it's one of those things where it's like, well, you can't do it until you get there. You know, like, I know, yeah, they both started games in the playoffs last year, but obviously it's only one series. So it's like, okay, yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe they do both flop, but the fact that you have two of them gives you a lot more hope. Like, you know, you would think if one does struggle at all, the other would be ready to go. And by the way, that's going to be, if this continues, that could be an interesting conversation that we're having down the line, because I think obviously everyone most of this season has been operating under the assumption of like, okay, you want to keep Allmark fresh, but look at the season he's having. He's obviously the guy come playoffs. And I think that's probably still true, but if they're like alternating starts and they're both playing at an elite level, like they have been for nearly 2 months now, like, I wonder, you know, like, how quick would the trigger be? Like, would Swayman get a chance at some point? Like, how would that work? Because again, this is now, you know, way down the line and a lot of things can change, but the way that they're going right now, it's like, you have to feel great with either one of them in there.
I know I do. I know I do for sure. It's just a matter of they haven't been there. So to your point, Scott, it's like it's nonsense to even have your mind go there or worry about that. You're gonna blame somebody or put something against them for something they haven't had a chance to do. So I think that's silly.
It's one of those things where like you're looking way ahead and reading way too into it. Like you're doing the what if scenarios that like have really honestly not shown that they're even very likely at all. Like you give it like a 5% chance that both of them are somehow playing bad at the same time, or even that one of them is playing bad at a given time. So you're just thinking like, no, it's not, it's really not something you have to worry about until we're like, you know, three games into a series and we're like, oh crap, like two bad games for Allmark and one bad game from Swayman, what the hell's going on?
So Bridget, here's a what if scenario for you. What if you were calling a game play by play as you often do?
And I will this weekend.
And you will this weekend. And what if you happen to cross the line and make some comments about one's weight? Would you by any chance go into that person's locker room after a morning skate and apologize face to face as one Jack Edwards did this afternoon?
First of all, would never ever say anything like that. And I mentioned that originally, like, especially since I broadcast men's and women's hockey, and broadcasting women's sports, like, and being a woman myself, you know, not to say stuff like that and that it's really not okay. So first of all, wouldn't have made a joke about it. I try not to like find myself making jokes on a broadcast because I don't think I'm that funny. at least in this kind of situation, like when I can't, you know, be 100% like get the tone right. And I know people wouldn't even care if I made a joke, so I don't really joke. But I think that the conversation with Maroon and Jack that transpired was because I believe Jack had tried to reach out to him before and wasn't like it wasn't as receptive, or it kind of just like wasn't able to happen. And
I think they just straight up ignored him. Like it sounds like he put in a request to talk to Maroon, you know, probably by phone, obviously, because at that point Bruins and Lightning weren't in the same city until now. And I think he just got ignored. I think Pat Maroon just had no interest in talking to him unless Jack Edwards was like literally standing right in front of him.
No, whoa. Not only that, he was on his knees.
Yeah.
He was like literally on his knees, like apologizing, like you see in like a movie, like, please, baby, take me back. Like
Bridget, real quick, just to clarify that first correspondence after the original joke, according to Pat Maroon, who mentioned this on a different podcast, he said that, and I think I told you guys this on back when it happened, but I guess Jack reached out to Tampa PR and basically said, here's my cell, here's my email, whatever, if Pat wants to reach out. And Maroon was like, no, you can call me. So that's why Jack got ignored, essentially, is because the Tampa side of things was like, no, we're not going to reach out to you. You messed up. You call him. And then fast forward to today, and here we are.
Yeah, and like to answer your question that you asked, would I go down and apologize and go to the locker room? I mean, if I genuinely felt like across the line, which I think Jack did, and I think he did feel bad, at least in the public eye, he took backlash for something that maybe he's not comfortable. Like, he hasn't apologized for certain things. So the fact that he did apologize for this means that he actually felt bad and felt like it was necessary. So,
but I mean, did he even really apologize? Because
he certainly didn't
initially. Like, there was no apology in his first statement about this. And then even today, like, so after this conversation with Maroon, he talked to both Matt Porter, The Globe, and I think he also talked to The Athletic or like one of the Tampa writers. And his comments afterwards were kind of along the lines of like, you know, I feel like people ran with it on social media, like blew it out of proportion. It still wasn't a like, yeah, I screwed up, I'm sorry. There was, you know, like an I'm sorry somewhere in there, but it was like still kind of couched in like this all blew up into something bigger than it should have been. And, you know, that like I wasn't trying to be offensive. I was, you know, I tried to give him credit too. Like, there's still a lot of like kind of almost like making an excuse for it, or
but like, you know, I do trying feel to
explain
like
it away rather than just saying, I screwed up, I'm sorry. That's it.
Yeah, you don't need to go into the extra stuff. Did it get blown up more than it needed to be? I think some players would have left it alone. And if Maroon just didn't say anything, like, we're not having this conversation at all. So I think it depends on the player and like what their past experience was, whether or not the social media part of it was going to go as crazy as it did and how widespread as it was. And also, like, Jack is Jack. I feel like people around the country don't really understand that we hear this all the time and that he just says some crazy stuff, and that's not an excuse, but like, I feel like he's so used to saying stuff like that. He didn't, when it came out of his mouth, he didn't think it was any different or weirder than stuff he says.
I think this was different. Like, it, even for him, I thought, you know, he doesn't talk about people's weight or appearances often. Like, it was different even for him.
Yeah. Well, wasn't it about pizza?
Well, it wasn't even what he said. It was how long he said it.
Yeah, true.
It got to the point where it was uncomfortable as a listener, because it's like, buddy, we're watching this channel because we're watching the product on the ice. So call what you're supposed to be calling. Like, we don't care to hear about your monologue about Pat Maroon, whether you're complimenting him or shitting on him. And, you know, that's what it came down to for most people. It's like, just Jack, just do your job, right? Just do your job. Like, you can be colorful if you want here and there, but like, just enough. Like, you're drawing attention away from the product on the ice. And that gets annoying at times, you know?
By the way, I, on my broadcast, when my color commentator likes to make a stupid pun, I will give him like the dirtiest look I can possibly give him. And we're not on camera, so no one can see it, but I'm just looking at him. And I just highly discourage bad puns and stupid jokes.
Yeah. But if you're going to go that route, you know, if you're a phenomenal play-by-play person, then I think that it could be forgiven. But if it, you know, if this were a contract year for Jack in the booth, the maroon stuff aside, it hasn't been a great year from calling games. He's lost his fastball, and you know, there could be one reason or another about that, but regardless, you know, so when that stuff came out on Twitter today, the picture of Jack kneeling down with the Jack swag that he had going on, with the white socks, with the black suit, the white Hanes socks. So I was like, well, I gotta find video of this. So like, you know, 20 minutes later, you know, oftentimes when the Bruins have a big game coming up, I'll go to the opposition's website and just kind of see what the other side's saying going into a game. And definitely I was gonna do that for Tampa Bay. So I wanted to watch John Cooper pregame and whoever else Tampa uploaded, and one of them was Anthony Cirelli. And I start watching Anthony Cirelli, and I sent this to you guys, and all of a sudden, right behind him, it was like a sitcom. It was Jack and Maroon having a conversation. I was like, how has this not gone viral? Like, everybody's trying to get the dirt on this interaction. All you have to do is just go on Tampa's website. And so between the reporters asking Cirelli questions and Cirelli answering them, and just chatter you hear in the locker room during these scrums, it was tough to make out what was being said. But I texted you guys a few things that Maroon, I could for sure hear Maroon say to Jack. And the one thing Maroon said to him was, you gave me a backhanded compliment, which tells me Jack was probably saying to him what you guys said. Like I was just teasing. I there was plenty of times I was complimenting you during the stretch, and Maroon probably said what I just said. You gave me a backhanded compliment. How would you wouldn't like it if I said that about your son or your daughter? And then you also hear Maroon say something like, do you want me to step on a scale and you can see what I weigh, or something like that. So, and what's funny is this video, it's Maroon's face is facing the camera, but all you can see is the back of Jack's head. So you just see Jack's head just kind of like still and like nodding here and there and whatnot. I sent you guys a video. It's pretty funny, but pretty wild circumstance.
Yeah. And the fact that wasn't recorded makes me like wonder whether or not like that wasn't like actually like reporters around it, makes me think maybe the team said like this is just like a side conversation, but it's right there in the middle of the locker room with like reporters around. So if that had happened in the Bruins locker room, someone would have had to say like, you can't like record this conversation. Otherwise, every reporter would have been right around it.
No, I think people are smart enough in that, in a situation like that. Like, you know when something's one-on-one and meant to be private. So,
well, why do you know, it in the
like occasionally there's a reporter who like occasionally there's a reporter who doesn't know better and butts in, but generally people can tell with that stuff.
Yeah, that was supposed to be a private conversation. What I more meant is it was picked up because of where it was in the background.
Well, yeah, it was still in a public setting. Like, you know, the locker room's open, so yeah, other media's in there. Other players were around. Like, Matt Porter of the Globe had an anecdote of, like, Ian Cole was just watching, and Matt quotes him as saying, like, I'm just hanging around to make sure Patty doesn't rip his head off. Like, so, you know, guys are like almost like joking about it, like as it's happening. So, yeah, just crazy scene. Like, you know, I'm sure Jag would have preferred it to be like out in the hallway, truly be one on one. But like, to the point I made earlier, if you're Pat Maroon, like, you're not going to go out of your way to accommodate it. So, yeah, if he wants to come in here and do it, you know, in front of everyone, then OK, like, I'll talk. But
that's maybe exactly
Jack.
It.
Maybe Jack was safer with witnesses.
What Scott just said is exactly how it went down too. You can just tell, like, because in the picture Pat's taking off his skates and he's not even looking at Jack. He's literally just taking off his untying his skates, like his head's down. So you know they got off morning skate, and you know somebody in PR went up to Pat and just said, hey, like, Edwards is here, like, do you want to talk to him? And Maroon probably just said, I mean, yeah, fine, if you I mean, I'm not just what just Scott just said. Like, yeah, he can come in here. I'm not going out there though.
Yeah.
So that was that. Hopefully this puts the whole thing to bed.
It does feel like it's just in general, it's something that I feel like at every turn where like it could have been sort of like died down or, you know, kind of reined in, it's just blown up bigger, like on both sides. And, you know, like for Pat Maroon, it's, you know, look, like if you don't like someone talking about your weight, like fine, totally understandable. I wouldn't want someone talking about my weight, but like, I don't know. I mean, you couldn't have just like talked to him by phone at some point. And that's what it means. Like Jack could have called him. He could have called, like, it never had to get here really on either side. And just feels like both of them kind of didn't handle it very well.
I think, but yeah, I think Maroon, like, I'm just spitballing based off of what I've heard him say about the situation. I think he cares more about the fact that Edwards went viral and got so much publicity because of it, and that his message about teasing somebody of body image is now at the exposure of people who might be going through shit like that. I think that's what Maroon was more so upset about, was how much exposure that rant got, more so than what it was actually said, because, you know, that's my two cents on it. I think Maroon hated the fact that it blew up, and that, you know, other people that might be self-conscious had to hear it. And I don't know. I mean, that's what was said. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I think I tweeted this out, like, well, so we'll see them in the ring at WrestleMania 39. I think that's in Los Angeles this year. And that'll be that. And they'll settle all filmy business right then and there. So
can you really take a guy seriously who twice tonight said tilt-a-whirl in a broadcast about hockey?
I mean, look, Jack.
Him and Brick were not on the same page on that one, because Brick's like, you can trademark that. And then Jack's like, Martian said it this morning. So,
well, I mean, that the broadcast.
I have no idea. I don't know.
The broadcast got off to a wild start tonight when they had their monologue, and the last thing Jack says is, coming up next, Bruins and Lightning, Eastern Standard Time. And Jack's like, I mean, Brick's like, what? And then,
like, he's like, he looks at him like, do you get it?
You can hear the crickets through the screen. And, you know, I mean, like, to your point, Bridget, like, yeah, Jack, like, we get it. You're saying that both of these teams are the gold standard in the East, and they're playing like Bob. We get it. But
I don't think everyone got it, including Brick. But
it took me like 10 seconds. I was like, what? I was like, oh, I see what he's saying. Okay.
But I was watching it with a few people. The room was split on who understood what the fuck was going on. But crap. Now I forgot what I was going to say. But I was going to say, Brian and I have both been producers at WEI, and we like to play cricket noises to people, and we just play, you know, little noises out of news boss and whatnot. And I feel like if Brian was producing that, he would have hit the crickets, and it would have made a lot of sense.
I would have just I would have just left the studio. I would have stopped producing. I mean, I'll tell you this much: if Jack had a dollar for every time he said that's the coin that won't get tossed, which you talk about all the time, Bridget, I mean, the guy would be the richest guy in the world. Now, what was the thing you told me, Bridget, in the past about this, like, Jack Edwards drinking game that people play? It's like a Jack Edwards bingo. You played a Jack Edwards drinking game, didn't you, or something like that?
No, I've seen the Jack Edwards drinking game, and it's just all the, like, key phrases: coin that won't get tossed, tumbling muffin, what are the other ones? Can of corn.
There's so many.
There is. He's been rounding the bases pretty much every game, so.
Yeah. Yeah, his slugging percentage is through the roof this year. All right, kids. Was there anything else you wanted to go over? We're about just at an hour right now.
Speaking of fights, Connor Clifton had a good one with Corey Perry tonight. You know, good for him sticking up for himself, because Perry kind of threw a cheap shot at him, and Clifton had already been hit, lost the puck, and Perry comes in late and catches him up high. So, you know, then Clifton went over, first gave him like a good cross check that I thought he was going to get called for a penalty on. Like, I thought the ref was going to catch that, you know, miss the initial hit, get the retaliation. But didn't call anything there. And then, you know, Perry wants to go with him. Clifton obliges and gets the win, you know, giving up some size against Perry. And, you know, I think that's something that a lot of NHL players would like to do is take down Corey Perry, because he's had a very long career of towing the line.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point about the cross check not being called, the ref was right there. And it just shows that I had no idea what was a penalty in this game. Nobody knew what was going to be a penalty and what wasn't going to be a penalty, but no. And Clifton did give up size. And it's funny because when I first saw their weights listed, I was kind of shocked. I was like, I didn't realize Corey Perry was that much bigger than Clifton. Clifton's kind of small, just to, you know, put that into it. But I don't, you think of him as like a little pest, right? Not like a somebody that's going to have size on a guy in a fight, but Clifton is a little bit small.
Yeah, Perry's got some size to him. He's got some height to him. Another thing worth mentioning too is obviously, like we'd said earlier, Taylor Hall went into Vasilevsky. Wasn't that violent at all, and obviously Tampa took exception to that. On the other end of the ice, a period later, Ross Colton, that was legit, went into like that. Nobody pushed him in, and he kind of gave Allmark a shoulder, and Derek Forbert took exception to it. And you know that scene in A Christmas Story when Ralphie finally beats up the bully and he sits up and he wipes his nose to get all the blood on himself? That's what Ross Colton looked like. I don't know when it happened or how it happened, but clearly something happened. Forbert looked like he broke his nose or something like that, because he was bleeding for a while.
Yeah, I was wondering like if Forbert, like, either, not that Forbert himself scratched him because he still had his glove on, but like, did he like drag his chin strap across or something? Like, I was wondering if something scratched Colton, because it didn't look like he got like punched or banged into the glass or anything like that. So I was wondering if like something got his visor, maybe got pushed in, like something like that.
I thought it was like when Forbert pushed him into the boards, like, and then Ross Colton went down. I think once that scrum ensued, I think maybe like the shaft of a stick maybe caught him across the bridge.
Yeah, that was like what I thought. And Forbert was also playing with gauze up his nose from like very early on, because he got high sticked in the face.
Yeah, but you would think that between intermissions they'd get it to stop. I was surprised to see it just stay in there for all 60 minutes.
Just chilling. Don't need to breathe out of that nostril.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so I'm, as a person who, fortunately, like, I don't get nosebleeds nearly as much as I used to, but I am someone who, when I get a nosebleed, like, it is very tough to stop. Like, it takes me a long time. So I can sympathize with Derek Forbert on not being able to get it to stop.
Yeah, I can't wait till next episode. Scott just pops on here with gauze up his nose. Scott, your nose bleeding? What? No, I just wanted to put some gauze on my nose. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Nosebleeds can be tough in the winter too with the dry air, but any event.
They're in Tampa.
No, I know. I'm talking about I get nosebleeds too up here in the winter sometimes, and they can be hard to stop. But I just kind of like blow my nose and try to. Now I'm getting too graphic. So. No need to go there. I think I just everybody's starting to puke now listening. So, okay, guys, I'm good. You good?
Yes. All good.
All right. Thank you all for listening. We will speak next after the back-to-back this weekend in Florida and in Carolina. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend.